is also working towards her master's in public policy.
Good morning. My name is Linnea Lestadius, and I'll be presenting today on state legislative efforts to reduce cancer health disparities among limited English proficient populations. No disclosures to make. So as we've already addressed, limited English proficient populations, or LEP populations, consist of those who do not speak English as their primary language or who have a limited ability to read, speak, write, or understand English. As with most chronic diseases, LEP poses a barrier to cancer services. So studies have indicated that LEP individuals are less likely to rate their cancer care positively, they're less likely to be screened for a number of cancers, and are less likely to have physicians even address screening with them. So I wanted to start off by addressing the federal requirements for the provision of services to LEP individuals. And really the basis for all of these requirements is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which states that no person in the U.S. shall, on the grounds of race, color, or national origin, be discriminated against under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So in 1974, in the Supreme Court case Lau v. Nichols, this was interpreted to include language ability as well under the national origin language. So given this, it was now determined that any provider receiving federal financial funds must treat non-English speakers the same as native English speakers. This was then elaborated on further under Alexander versus Sandoval, which then favored a more narrow interpretation. So prior to Alexander v. Sandoval, LEP individuals could file a lawsuit against providers if they didn't receive services. However, after this case, you could now only sue if you can prove deliberate discrimination versus disparate impact discrimination. So you're now the recourse now, if you can't prove deliberate action, is to go through the Office of Civil Rights and file a complaint. There's also a number of federal guidance documents regarding LEP. In 2000, President Clinton issued an executive order essentially reaffirming Lau v. Nichols and stating that every federal agency has to work to ensure that recipients of federal assistance provide meaningful access to LEP applicants and beneficiaries. In 2000 as well, the class standards were issued, which have already been addressed. Four of those are specific to language services. In 2000 as well, the Office of Civil Rights issued guidance, which was then further elaborated on in 2003, stating that health providers must ensure that LEP individuals receive language access necessary to obtain meaningful access free of charge. You'll notice that the language regarding meaningful access is used a lot. That, in the 2003 definition, really tried to include the resources of the provider. So it's not saying that every provider has to provide services to every language. It's really within the context of what they can afford to do. In 2000 also, the director of CMS issued a letter stating that all this applies to state Medicaid agencies as well as providers of Medicaid services. And also in this letter, it was explained that there are matching funds available for state Medicaid programs to draw down for interpretation services. So why do we need state laws and regulations when we have all these federal regulations and guidelines already? Studies have indicated that both providers and LEP patients are simply unaware of the current federal requirements. So obviously this means that they're less likely to be provided, and if patients aren't aware of these requirements, they're less likely to ask for them or to complain if they're not being made available. Enforcement of Title VI at the federal level is both time-consuming and difficult, especially after Alexander versus Sandoval, and especially if you already don't speak English, it's difficult to file a complaint and go through this whole process. There's also, the federal guidelines are intentionally quite flexible due to concerns about costs and burdens. So states really have the opportunity to create policy that will meet the needs of their particular populations. Then finally, federal legislation to strengthen LEP rights has yet to be passed. It's been introduced in a number of Congresses, but really has yet to make it out. So the purpose of this study was to examine state-level policy measures aimed at reducing cancer health disparities arising from LEP. We also wanted to establish a systematic classification scheme that would allow us to compare policy measures between states. Then we also wanted to expand upon data found in the NCI State Cancer Legislative Database Program, which really holds a vast array of abstracts regarding cancer legislation and now disparities in cancer as well. And generally, this does not include regulations, but our project officer gave us permission to expand this to regulations to really give a fair picture of what states have been doing in terms of LEP policy. So we started off by identifying non-geographically diverse states, as you can see here, and then using primary legal research, we conducted Lexis searches of state statutes and regulations. So we developed a classification scheme that would allow for descriptive quantification of state-level cancer-related LEP measures. So essentially, for example, we created a scale of 1 through 6, and then depending on what the states had been doing, we assigned a different numerical value depending on what the state policy contained. And that was derived largely from HHS policy guidance and from the class standards. And then we also solicited feedback from Guadalupe Pacheco of the Office of Minority Health. So this is essentially a six-tiered classification scheme for the pilot study. So we tried to identify states with legislation and regulations that require assessment of the needs of LEP populations, evaluation of their state LEP programs and policies, require the provision of translation and or interpretation services, require those interpreters or translators to be certified by the state, require medical providers and staff to be trained on the needs of LEP populations, and finally that require patient navigators or case managers to be made specifically available to LEP populations. So just looking at a brief overview of our results, you can see that all the pilot states had some sort of policy in place regarding interpretation and translation, whereas there was much less policy activity regarding, for example, certification and the patient navigators. So the limitations of the study, we did not address Medicare or SCHIP. Also, since the study was cancer-focused, we obviously did not address, for example, mental health or family planning services. Also, given that this was a pilot study, it was somewhat limited in scope, so we did not address reimbursement rates or signposting requirements, which are things we might expand to include at a later date. And then finally, we did not address local regulations or sort of informal internal state documents. So I want to give you sort of examples of what has been done in each of these topic areas to give you a sense of what's out there, and then also where there are opportunities for growth. So in regards to assessment, California and Illinois both require state agencies and departments of health to periodically assess the needs of the LEP population served, whereas other states only have more limited requirements, for example, New York and New Mexico, which only have requirements for insurers and hospitals to assess their served populations. Similar things are found regarding evaluation, with California requiring medical societies and state agencies to evaluate their efforts to meet LEP needs, whereas Texas, having a pilot program for the provision of LEP services in hospitals, required that to be evaluated. We found a range of requirements in terms of interpretation, some much more comprehensive than others. For example, in New York, the Patient's Bill of Rights for hospital patients includes the offer of free interpretation services, versus Florida, which requires that healthcare facilities make interpretation services available when such a person is readily available. No states address physicians directly. They're either addressing state agencies, facilities, or insurers. California had the broadest regulation stating it's a discriminatory practice for anybody receiving state funds to not take action to make language services available, but even then they didn't specify physicians directly. In regards to requirements on insurers for interpretation requirements, we found that these applied both to medical settings, but then also to assistance with enrollment, contracts, and grievance procedures. And most of the provisions we found applied to Medicaid and Medicaid managed care plans, but six of the states did have some sort of requirement for private insurers to provide services. We have something we did note about interpretation requirements is that a number of states had language thresholds. So essentially, once the minority language population reaches a certain size, the provider or State Department of Health must then begin to recognize that population. So for example, in Massachusetts, community health centers must employ at least one practitioner or translator for every substantial population, which is then defined as 10% or more of the total member population. In New Mexico, it was 5%. Then other states, such as Washington, did not use a threshold, simply saying that they have to have sufficient staff to meet the needs of LEP individuals. For translation requirements, we found things from medical forms at hospitals and then official State Department of Health documents and educational materials. Something interesting we did note is that the majority of the provisions regarding cancer and language specifically tied together were in terms of screening and our treatment information documents. So for example, in California, breast, cervical, gynecological, and prostate cancer screening or treatment documents must be translated into other languages than specified in the law or regulation. And similar provisions are found in Illinois and Massachusetts. And you'll note that most of these cancers are female-specific cancers, which was also an interesting finding. For insurers, common requirements included translating enrollment documents, contracts, grievance procedures, but then as noted under the interpretation section, a number of states require interpreters or call centers to be available to help people understand the written materials. We only found one state that has certification requirements for interpreters, and that was Washington State. So anybody in Washington providing services to Department of Social and Health Services to LEP persons must be certified. Then they have their own examination for that. Something we did note was that other states did have certification requirements, but not for medical settings, only for legal procedural settings. So it's not that the states aren't recognizing the importance of certifying individuals, it's just that they haven't gotten round to doing it for medical settings at this point. We found somewhat more activity regarding medical staff training, with 4 states having such provisions, California again having the broadest provisions, requiring health insurers to train their staff on LEP needs, requiring continuing medical education courses for physicians, and having interagency training. More specific provisions are found in New York, which requires that hospitals train their staff having direct interaction with LEP individuals on the services that they have. In regards to case management and patient navigators, California and Texas had provisions regarding this. California requiring the targeted case management services be made available to Medi-Cal beneficiaries with language barriers. And in Texas, the State Department of Health and Human Services must use certified promotoras for health outreach and education programs to medical assistance recipients. So some of our initial findings, we found that the threshold for language services varied widely among states, and sometimes even between settings and states. So there really doesn't appear to be a generally agreed upon notion of how big a language minority needs to be before it is acknowledged through policy. We also found that most of the cancer-specific provisions were found in the written translation requirements, specifically in regards to screening and treatment information documents. So there is not a whole host of cancer and LEP-specific provisions that are tied together in the language. And then we also found that states are focusing their policy efforts on insurers and facilities rather than addressing physicians directly. And this is generally because it's simply more politically feasible to address this at a higher level simply because of the cost than to say that every family practice and every individual physician has to make these services available. And then also, it's simply easier to enforce at a higher level. And then in conclusion, even among the 9 pilot states, there was really a great deal of variation in the approach to language services. And then within states, we really didn't see consistent policies across all medical settings. So they will address one type of insurer but not another, or hospitals but not community health centers. So it's somewhat of a patchwork approach at the moment. And really, states have made very little headway in certifying interpreters, at least among the pilot states. But we will say that all the states we reviewed haven't made at least an effort to begin to address LEP services for cancer services, LEP services to cancer patients. So certainly states are beginning to acknowledge the importance of this. And then we identified some next steps. We hope to convene a panel of experts with the NCI Center to reduce cancer health disparities to really expand the scope of this and refine the classification scheme. We ultimately want to expand it to all 50 states and DC, and then really keeping in mind throughout this whole process to keep it as accessible and relevant to providers and policymakers at the state level as possible. And that concludes our presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linnea. So, now we will open it up to questions. We have about 20 minutes for questions and answers. You could ask specific questions or general questions, and they're all comments, so please. Sure. Let's see. It's taped, so no. You guys can come on up if you'd like.
I think that's a great question. So what about culture, and how does that interrelate with language? What we found is realistically culture swamped language, and I didn't show any data from that on our side. But what we were realizing is that even though we tried to address language access, if we didn't address the bias and discrimination that was really more color-bound and cultural, not just color, we weren't making any difference in terms of getting the languages, whether it's interpreting or materials or translation of materials, it wasn't working. So one of the things that we worked on is role plays and actually working with providers and staff to put themselves in a position as artificial as that was, and try to understand what the cultural barriers are. You'll see that a lot in movies where you watch a movie and someone's been transported back in time or has been transported to a culture that doesn't exist anymore, like the 1970s movie. I don't know if you've watched that recently where someone's been put back to 1970s and what's it like. And although they were funny and not necessarily as controversial, the role plays helped both staff and providers start thinking about how important culture was, regardless of whether they had access to translation or interpreting.
So also to your question, so one of the things that we try to do is actually we look at culture, which is kind of tricky because when you're putting out a job description, you can't hire people based on race and color. But you, when you're actually interviewing, you could actually ask questions in regards to how do you feel about this particular culture, or like he has stated, a role play, like give a scenario how you will handle that particular situation. And another thing that we actually like to look at is actually we look at gender as well, how people relate to specific genders, how people relate to specific ages. And so when we're recruiting volunteers, we tend to recruit people from various ages. So seniors, we look at teenagers. And so we look at all those aspects, but it's when you're questioning people who are working for your agencies, where you could do that, but not put it on job description.
Hi, to address your question, here at HelpNet, we have two things that we are doing to help the providers. First of all, we have a lot of culture guide for providers to use. So these are some of the references that they can use to communicate with the patients. And the second thing that we're doing is that if the providers has a need, then we can provide culture training with the provider, the doctor himself or herself, and plus the staff. So that's available for our physicians and provider groups to use. Although I have to say that this service and program is very underutilized. I mean, it's great that physician or provider like yourself is sensitive to the cultural needs, but unfortunately, even though we really try to promote the service, you know, a lot of physicians' offices are not using the available services. Thank you.
And